Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we bring the culture to horticulture. We're going to start today's show with our horticultural honoree of the week.
Yes.
Jack. Horticultural honoree of the week. Boop.
You've gotten good at it. Thank you.
This woman, Vita Sackville West.
Yes.
Was a woman who gardened and defined her life as she determined. So this honoree is going to go to Vita Sackville West for individuality in the garden. And DeVito...
DeVito does Vita.
Does Vita today.
Yes. So Vita Sackville West, a lot of you probably have heard of her in passing.
Pretty controversial.
Yeah. And her association with Virginia Woolf. This is how she describes gardening.
Herself.
And I quote, "Ah, it, gardening, in quotes, is heavenly while it lasts, a sort of intoxication. You see suddenly, as in a finished picture, the entire shape and design of what you want to do. I don't say that you ever carry it to your satisfaction, but for one brief moment of illumination, you have apprehended the unity of what you meant. That is one of the few moments in life worth living." And I've felt that moment.
Yeah.
I have felt that experience.
I feel that daily.
You know, you're lucky. If you've ever created a garden or thought about a garden, I think you've felt that feeling. So who was Vita? When I think about Vita, I think one word comes to mind immediately, and that's maverick.
Mm.
That's the word that I associate with Vita. She kind of came into her own just about 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was an Edwardian lady. She was a writer first as profession, if you would call it, you know, profession. In her case, garden designer and a very controversial figure. She had several affairs both with men and women, and of that time it was quite shocking. She was born an aristocrat, an English aristocrat. And she had kind of an exotic, illegitimate kind of past. Her mother was part Spanish, right? And she had this like sort of grand upbringing. But being that she was a girl, female, she was not deeded the family house when her father passed. So in her biography, she says that she turned to plants to sort of fill that gap. And her gardens and her writing are described as savage and patrician. She defied traditional formality and designed this garden at Sissinghurst in this like sort of wild planting style. For her, plants were as real as people. They had personalities. They were appealing. They had unappealing traits. They had physical attractions. They had elements of mystery. She once described a particularly exasperating member of her family as being, and I quote, "as floppy as an unstaked delphinium in a gale."
I know some people like that.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of her pen.
No,
you know?
Right.
But it was plants that she considered her own contribution to the garden at Sissinghurst, the maximum sort of informality in planting. And her husband, his contribution, by contrast, was the strictest formality of design. So there was this...
interesting pair.
Yeah. You know, very English, very, very structured, and yet wild. You
crazy
know?
Wild.
Crazy
right.
wild. And I see that in the English character, mm-hmm. you know? She's described sort of as an archetype of this kind of green-fingered, aristocratic English chatelaine. She was known at the time as England's Rose Queen by American journalists. But her life was kind of complicated. It wasn't quite that simple or as sweet. Her mother, Lady Sackville, described Vida as a beautiful mask. The surface concealed unexpected secrets, hopes, anxieties, and fears that were less beautiful. And as Virginia Woolf, the most famous of her lovers, described Vida, all about her is savage and patrician. So imagine,
yeah,
the kind of garden.
Savage and patrician.
It's such an incredible bipolar, yeah, you know, contrast. And so in her garden, as in her writing, she found a channel for those savage impulses, which arose specifically in response to one aspect of her aristocratic life. So she didn't get her home, but she got something so much more.
Right.
You know, her vision was so too big, too romantic, and also too personal for conventional notions of good taste. She defied typical female fashion. She wore knickers and pants. She had an affair with Virginia Woolf, which
and many other women.
And many other women at the same time as she was married,
right,
to Nicholson. In fact, there's a great movie called Orlando.
Right.
And it's sort of kind of based on Woolf's novel,
right,
called Orlando. Anyway, Vida is the perfect symbol and perfect hero for this show.
So for this show, we have an amazing guest.
Yes.
We have our friend Rochelle Grayer, who was trained as a garden designer and garden person in England. Mm-hmm. She is the author of Cultivating Garden Style. Rochelle is the founder and editor also of a magazine called Pith and Vigor, a literary newspaper and an online magazine for garden enthusiasts. In addition, she is the creator of the popular blog Studio G, named one of the top 10 gardening blogs by the editors of Better Homes and Gardens. She's the co-founder and editor of Leaf Magazine, a digital design magazine for garden makers, and a weekly columnist for the Gardenist for Apartment Therapy. She's one of the most influential which is one of the most influential interior design sites on the web, according to Forbes magazine.
And Rochelle has been here before.
Yes, she joined us at the launch of Leaf Magazine about a year and a half, 2 years ago, something like that. She's a graduate.
Three, actually, wasn't it?
3 years? Yeah.
Wow. It's been that long.
Wow. So she's a graduate of the English Gardening School in London, and she's been designing gardens for private residences and hotels around the world since 2002. She's a lover of fresh, homegrown food. She is also one of the founders of the Harvard Farmers Market, the largest weekly farmers market in central Massachusetts. Prior to her garden design and writing career, she was literally a physicist rocket scientist, riding in the cockpits of F-14s and F-18s and helping launch Russia's first commercial satellite. And now she's a garden designer. So welcome, and thank you for joining us again.
And you can see the comparisons to Vida Sackville West, right?
Obviously.
You are a maverick.
Yeah.
Top Gun was one of my favorite movies.
Yeah. So before we get into Pith and Vigor magazine and your new book, let's talk about how you left your rocket science job and came to horticulture.
I was living in or working in London. I started out after graduating from college working for Hughes Aircraft and worked on a number of different things, but mostly F-18 flight simulators, which are amazing things. They're these ginormous multi-story domes that have graphics all around you, and you're in a real cockpit from a real F-18 running all of the equipment. So they're very, very cool.
Yeah.
And then I went on from there to help launch commercial satellites and spent time in Norway and Russia doing that. And basically yeah, I had a really good time doing that. But as these things sort of go, the more you, you kind of evolve over time. And after a while, I sort of evolved into this software development management role, which was a whole lot less fun than...
Yeah. It sounds like more fun to sit in the F-18.
It really was. And I kind of, you know, I don't know, management can sort of quickly burn out and it becomes, at least for somebody like myself, increasingly, you know, mind-numbing and not filling the kind of creative and, if not creative, at least exciting sort of aspect of work that I kind of am always looking for. So, I was in London and I was miserable at that point. I was working for Nortel Networks and I had, however, just learned that the campus I was working at, this large campus, like 20,000 people or something like that, was shutting down. And so I knew that, you know, everybody there, including myself, we weren't going to have jobs within the next, you know, year or so, and right. They shut down the whole campus. And I went to the Chelsea Flower Show, and I was kind of in this place of like, I don't know if I can do this again. I was so kind of burnt out to start a new company, and you know, and I had this like big severance package, and I was just blown away. I'd been a gardener my whole life. My parents are gardeners, and I never considered that landscape design could actually be a real job.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea. I truly had no idea. And in England, you know, garden designers are like rock stars, and garden
right.
design shows
yeah.
are on primetime TV.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And it's like the coolest thing ever. And the gardens at Chelsea are just amazing.
Yeah.
And there's just nothing that isn't amazing about it. And, I knew that day. It was like a revelation to me that there was actually in existence this whole industry of around garden design. And because I had always kind of thought, even when I was in college, I graduated with a degree in physics, but my second choice, and I kind of considered changing on more than one occasion, was architecture.
Uh-huh.
And so I just always kind of had this sort of design thing. And so the combination of the two just, that was the end of the story. I signed up and I went to school that very fall.
So yeah, so you went
to severance package and paid for school.
So tell us about school. How long were you in school, and was it a design degree or was it more of a horticulture degree?
So English Gardening School has a bunch of different programs. I was in the design program, which is like a full-time immersive thing, but they also have some other amazing things like plants and plantsmanship and even like botanical painting and various horticulture things. But I was in the design track, and it was a full year. They don't really take as long of summers as we do, so it was kind of like August to July sort of thing.
Okay.
And it was at the end of it, you know, you're there every single day, all day, for a year. And at the end, you kind of, you know, an awful lot.
Yeah.
That's the program I did. And, I had commissions, right before I even graduated. So I started immediately working on my own.
Wow.
Which I sometimes actually regret, because I, you know, being an entrepreneur, you have to figure everything out for yourself. And
yeah.
I kind of sometimes look back on that and think, gosh, if I had just spent a year or two working for somebody else, I might have not had to figure so many things out myself. But,
right.
You know,
yeah. Right.
Whatever.
Alice and I know that pain.
Well, but yeah. Carmen, yeah. we worked at the Hort Society, so we had that a little bit of a background.
Yes,
you
yes,
know?
It's true.
Yeah,
so, we did.
But we
did.
So, you know, I feel like I'm still learning every day, though. I'm like, how do I do this HTTM,
yeah.
HTML website thing, you know?
Yeah.
I have to send somebody some photos, and they're too big, and how do I scale them? And So you also, when did you come to the States? How did you decide to come to the States?
So it was, just a little, just 10 years ago, in this last August, was our 10th anniversary of coming back. But we, there were a lot of things. It was kind of, I know this is, a lot of people say this, but post September 11th, and we were, you know, kind of feeling this like weird thing of being Americans abroad that suddenly didn't feel quite as like, bright and shiny as it once did. And I don't know. And it just, and we, I had a 2-year-old at that point and who was born in England. And we weren't really sure, you know, we wanted to be so far away from family and home. And so we just decided on our own after we'd been there for 4 years, to come home. And settle. You know, we were at this, we lived in Notting Hill and we were at this stage of sort of needing a bigger place to live. And, you know, so it was really sort of the breaking point of, you know, do we buy here? If we, you know, we kind of knew that was the point of like, we could make a decision. And if we make one decision, we're going to stay in England forever or we're going to go home. You know, and it was, we were just at that point. And so,
and then you immersed. And you immersed yourself right into community work, right? And you start, that's when you started the farmers market?
I did. I we came back and as I said, I had a 2-year-old and who is very into the arts herself, and she, you know, even still. But she was taking little tiny dance lessons, and I met through that, and her little preschool, two other moms who had daughters of the same age, and they lived in my town, and we had similar interests, and we kind of had this sort of opportunity for a half an hour every twice a week or something like that. There was a Starbucks just near where their little dance studio was, and we, as we sat there drinking coffee, we were like, we need a farmer's market.
Yeah.
And that was how that started. And we launched one the following spring, and it's about to be, so it's in its ninth year, the farmer's market, which is amazing. I mean, it, and it's grown, it's huge. It's like an institution in our town now. It's, it's fantastic. And we do a lot of other things besides just farmer's market. We do a lot of education. We feed people throughout the year, particularly elderly soups for seniors and all kinds of programs to kind of make a connection between people who don't have fresh, locally grown food in our community and people who grow locally grown food.
No, that's amazing. So you're obviously still connected with the market and you...
Yep, I am. I am on the board of directors and... we've grown up a lot, actually, in the last 10 years. We have a board of directors, and we are a 501c3 now. And I mean, we're a real thing.
It's really nice. Well, I have a question for you, Rochelle. So what was the – was there a little bit of sort of culture shock or a little bit of a transition back to the States after living in England for a while? Were there things that, you know – you were surprised by or changes in the U.S.?
I wouldn't say I was surprised by anything because, of course, I grew up here. I grew up in Colorado, actually. I think living abroad changed my husband and I more than anything else. I feel like we were very different people coming back than we were when we left. And,
interesting.
And that was sort of an interesting thing of just, you know, how our worldview had sort of changed and you know, who we were sort of and our, you know, what meant a lot to us had sort of changed. And, you know, some of that goes with, you know, having children and stuff like that. But
yes,
I think just as much, though, it came from, you know, for me and career-wise, I mean, in England, there's such a strong gardening culture.
Yes,
and it's such a such a way of life for everybody. Even people who don't really garden, they still know things and they still understand it, and they still like there's still a basic level of education and understanding, and that's fantastic. But I think the more interesting piece to that is how that sort of takes the next step forward and how that plays out in like their politics and how people, you know, view various issues of the day and land management and the environment and just all kinds of, you know, big world issues, you know, and it's so completely different than when
people
have that basic knowledge.
So you're saying that their cultural identity, gardening is a big part of their cultural identity, and it affects, I mean, it's a small island relative to the United States, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So how is it to work? So when you came back to the States and you started your design business, I'm curious, you know, as a garden designer myself, I hope I'm not going too much off the rails here, but you had clients in England.
That knew their plants,
obviously, as you're saying, you know, had more of a basic knowledge. And then you come to the States and you're
faced with foundation plants.
Yeah. How was, you know, did you have to kind of change the way that you worked to work with American clients, you know?
No, not really. Yeah. I would say in England, it was like terrifying at first because I thought, oh my God, these people are going to know more than I know. I mean, I just spent all this time in school, but still, right. I mean, you know, I could kind of not know nearly what they might know. And the difference is, I think that because there's a sort of greater basic knowledge, designers, I think, are respected for, being design professionals more readily, I think, than perhaps here, where I think in general, anybody who is working in a nursery or as a designer or as a grower or a horticulturalist or any of these sorts of things, which are all quite different, it seems to me like everybody kind of gets lumped into one thing, you know, and that doesn't happen so much. So, you know, you're sort of battling that, you know, and people are, you know, as a designer, you're kind of, you know, you're working on a design and somebody wants to know what this, like, little bug is underneath the leaf and you're not entirely sure.
Right, right.
You know, you don't always know because it's not your real specialty. But, you know, you try. Here, I feel like you have to be more of a jack of all trades because that's the expectation, or you at least try to be that. And I find that to be a bigger challenge here than there.
Interesting. No, that's good. I'm glad that I can imagine. I mean, if I went to England tomorrow, I would be intimidated.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
To suddenly work on projects, no matter how many years I've been doing it here, you do get the sense that the English really know their stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they do. But they also have a lot of greater tools to help you do your thing. You know, they have like these, the RHS is a fantastic resource, but even just, you know, like working as a designer, the plant finder, like the RHS puts out this book called The Plant Finder, and literally any plant you can research, first of all, like everything grows there, but any plant you can research, you can generally find it, which that's just not the case in the States.
And you
can go to this book and it'll tell you what nurseries across the country are growing that plant. And there's, you know, this huge array of nurseries growing.
Oh,
everything.
I can just
everything.
Imagine the nurseries
it's
there.
Amazing.
It's like plant nirvana, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
I
did a show garden there, and you know, we planted all kinds of crazy things that, you know, we were looking for plants, you know, based on certain qualities, and we borrowed plants and all kinds of things. And just even the plants that went into my own garden were it was amazing, the variety that we were able to come up with. You know, you can do research on them and learn about them and then actually be able to source them, which is
Tough here. It's tough in the
it's
States.
It's tough here.
Yeah.
It's tough here, yeah.
So you won the Royal Horticultural Society's Bronze Medal for your show garden at the Royal Hort Society's Hampton Court Palace Flower Show in 2003.
It did?
Yes.
I can't believe they gave that to an American. Hey, Michelle.
Well,
you were trained in the British school.
Yeah, they give it on the merit. It's one of those, you know, I think all designers probably look back at sort of their early design work and you might have sort of strong feelings about, like, what was I thinking? Or, you know,
oh, it's embarrassing sometimes. Like,
Or it's embarrassing. I have to say, this garden, I feel all of those feelings, but then I also feel like, you know, it was such a unique thing. Like, I got to forgive myself because, the garden was built for an organization who, a charity organization who, championed the, interests of women and children who are affected by domestic violence.
Okay.
And so it had this message of awareness about domestic violence, and in doing that, it they had this project called Silent Witness, where they took these cutouts of women and children who were victims of their partners. And they had these like plaques on the front that told their story, and so they were real women, and there were these cutouts, and they were painted red, and anyway, so the garden had these figures with their stories, and so trying to build sort of a garden around something.
Wow. How did you? So what was what was your design inspiration for that?
It was, well, there was a lot of things. We kind of went with, I found it all, like, this question of, like, you know, that domestic violence can seem so unreal on so many different levels. Like, you know, when you're not part of it, it's hard to imagine it ever happening to you or to somebody else. When you, you know, are a victim of it, it's just, you kind of feel like, how is this happening to me? And,
right.
And how, you know, it's just this sort of intensely, you know, unnatural and unacceptable sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, and so in that mindset, I went sort of with this, it felt right to, it took a lot of inspiration from, surrealist art.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just symbolism on symbolism layered all over the place, but
right.
You know, and so we had like a water feature, for example, that really wasn't a water feature. It was this river of plants. It was all planted with succulents that looked like rippling water, and there was, you know, all these very sort of interesting plants that were, you know, kind of unreal looking, you know, like, what is that? You know, that and so there was, I'm trying to remember some of the other things. There was a lot of symbolic planting in there. And
well, I'd love to see, maybe you can send us some photos if you have them, and we'll share them, because it sounds very interesting.
Sure.
But we have to take a break, Rochelle.
Stay
on the line. We're going to come back on We Dig Plants. We're going to talk about your newest work, your book, Cultivating Garden Style, and Pith and Vigor, your new magazine.
Okay.
All right, stay on the line.
Heritage. Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine?
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Jack, that was a nice little piece on Heritage. Well
Thanks.
Done. So we're back. We're talking with Rochelle Grayer about her gardening work, her media work, and her new book via Timber Press, which is called Cultivating Garden Style.
Yes.
And she describes the book this way. You share ways to create outdoor areas that are charming, comfortable, appealing, and reflect individuality. It features 23 unique garden styles accompanied by advice on how to recreate the look. You offer suggestions for everything from plants and pavers to pillows and potting soils. Simple step-by-step projects like how to make a macrame plant hanger help the reader personalize the space. And you also offer helpful how-to tips and tricks. For example, how to pick the right tree and pick the right combination of plants and containers, offering essential lessons in gardening and in design. So when I looked through the book, which I loved, what stood out to me was the chapter titles.
Yes.
In that I'm just going to read through some of them. Abstract Vogue, Wabi Sabi Industrial, Tropical Noir, Low Country Shaman, Plush Yoga, and Boho Style.
Wait.
My favorite.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
You didn't mention Thorovian Wabi, all right?
So what I loved about it is that it's exactly as you would informally describe them to your friends, you know?
Yes.
And I think you've picked apart and you've shown readers how to really establish your own personal style. And you've really tapped into art and fashion and like music, like everything in your world and how you can incorporate that into the garden making.
It's a cultural, it's, we've seen, there's a million garden design books out.
Right.
I've seen them all. This one takes a really different approach, Rochelle.
Uh-huh.
It really does. You really tapped into a cultural vein, I
yeah.
think, with this.
So how did you select the gardens and the gardeners that you profile in the book?
Well, interestingly, the list of 23, there's 23 of these styles, was something that has truly just been in my head for so many years. I think, you know, probably 7 or 8. When I sat down to kind of write them down, I just kind of, you know, it was one of those things where I literally wrote them all down in like 5 minutes, and then they changed so little through the whole process, which I found extraordinary because I was like fully willing to change them and kind of modify them as I
yeah.
wrote the book.
Yeah, yeah.
But they largely stuck. We like altered a word here and there, but they really were a reflection of things I'd seen while traveling and kind of, you know, in my own head, you know, my own sort of categorization of things.
Right.
You know, I kind of I'd seen things that, you know, I kind of started to lump things together and they were also, I think, you know, while they sound a little bit offbeat, a lot of them are based in sort of really traditional styles
mm-hmm.
that we are all well and comfortable with and talking about, you know, like the modern cottage. But it's cottage, but it's definitely, you know, a cottage garden isn't isn't all that appropriate for modern living, but, you know, a modern version of it certainly is.
Yeah.
And
I like the way you break it down. Like, in the boho style, there's nouveau bohemian, gypsy yeah. bohemian. There's the beat bohemian, and then the dandy bohemian. And then you have the images
yeah.
of the objects that you use,
yes.
you know, the objet d'art, if you will,
yes.
to explain the very slight differences, or I shouldn't say they're slight because they're not, but between nouveau and gypsy and beat and dandy. And,
yes.
you know, it's very, very, very well done and really a curated list. So how did you, like, which came first? All these styles that were in your brain, or was it the gardeners that, or the gardens that you had seen?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it was a little bit of both.
Uh-huh.
Certainly kind of the, you know, each chapter has four sort of twists on the main style, like the dandy beat, which by the way is from, a playoff of Lauren Stover's, Bohemian Manifesto, which is a really fun book that I kind of love, where she talks about, you know, all the different types of bohemians.
And the word dandy is so wonderful. Like, I think people need to use the word dandy more often.
So all of those sort of sub things were, you know, I kind of, you know, came to each chapter and was working on it, it was sort of like, well, you know, for me, that was sort of a lot of the fun. It was almost like where I was doing a little bit of design work as I wrote the book. You know, I had this idea of this bohemian garden or a retro rockery sort of thing, which, you know, sort of for whatever reason, it seems like rockeries and like people who like to collect like vintage stuff just always seem to go hand in hand. And cottage, like, you know, and the whole Zen thing is
yes.
you know, it's gone very rustic
yeah.
lately. You know, it's not so like austere. I mean, it is austere, but it's
not the Japanese, right.
Not quite as Japanese. It's just sort of, it's just more woody and, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, they've evolved, design styles evolve over time. So anyway, as I like looked at each one and kind of started to put together ideas, those sort of came later for sure, these sort of twists. And I actually really love that. I we have these 23 chapters and then each chapter has four sort of sub twists.
Yeah.
And I've done math at some point. I'm going to embarrass myself trying to do mental math right now, but it's like 80-some styles
yeah.
in this book.
You can find Timber Press had a sort of quiz
right.
earlier in the month, you know, and it was fun to see
yes.
where you would fall.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
And what I like about it, the layout as well, is that, you know, it's becoming much more and more visual world
medium. Yeah.
and medium, and people don't use as many words, you know, to communicate. And I think clients and individuals who are interested in gardening, they can show you what they want or like,
yeah.
but
yeah.
they can't say, oh, I want an English potager necessarily, you know. And so
yeah.
your images and your language really makes it simple for an individual and even a designer to use this book to sort of show someone, say, is this like the broad idea? Is this
well,
the
and
feeling,
I love, yeah.
you know?
And what I love is that yeah. you take like objects and then you kind of pair them with a style. So, you know, pergolas or small houses in the garden or swings or fabrics or a piece of sculpture or a planter. And that one or two, you know, those few pieces can springboard you into a whole language and style that you wouldn't necessarily think about. But I love the way you approach it through, you know, through objects. And it's not the typical, like, if you want this style, use these plants.
Right,
know?
Exactly.
It's not that recipe.
No, there isn't. I mean, there are lots of plants featured in it, but that's not the focus.
No.
Rochelle, the plants
yeah.
are part of it, but it's an overall, it feels like feelings, emotion.
Yeah, it's fantasy.
It's an achievable fantasy.
Yeah.
Because the things that you're showing, you're not showcasing $10,000 chaises. You know what I mean?
Like,
it's very approachable.
Accessible.
You know? Mm-hmm. And the gardens themselves seem to be very personal as well. Some of them are designed by designers, professional designers, but a lot of them, it seemed, based on my perusal, were designed by the people that live in the gardens. Am I right?
Yes. I would. I don't know that I've counted up, but yeah, there's definitely as many or more non-designer gardens as there are designer gardens. Although I will say there are a bunch of them that are the gardens of designers themselves, own gardens. I think that personally, I've been a designer for many years now, and this book was kind of something I wished existed for so many years.
Yeah.
I wished it existed because I wanted to be inspired by it, but I also wished it existed because I wanted to help my clients be able to tell me what they like and what they don't like and what they're interested in. And I think that's really, really hard for people to do. Designers, garden designers come into people's homes and, you take a read on a person, what they're wearing, what their house is decorated like, and all kinds of things. And if you can't get a read on that,
how successful is the project?
You really struggle.
Yeah, it is.
To know what they're like and what they're going to like and what you might design for them. So,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, my goal with this, there's so many pictures in this book. It's like 1,000+ pictures, is that every single person could find at least one picture that completely spoke to them in this book. Just one.
Yeah.
So I found many.
Yeah, me
I found
too.
Many.
It was hard not to love them all.
Well, from one designer to another, Rochelle. So let's say you find the client, you get in there, and it's like the blandest, the most
vanilla
Pottery Barned up, residence, right?
Right.
You come in with this book and you can change.
You can change.
You can
illuminate their
and completely
their dark corners.
Yeah. Right? We've all had them. We've all had the client that formulaically filled their home,
Yeah, that's the whole movie Fight Club and the whole IKEA, lifestyle that the guy lives. Like, that's the whole fantasy idea, right?
Right.
To change it up, right?
Not Pottery Barn. I like it, but honestly, that is kind of the essence of one of the chapters, is sort of this earthy contemporary, and that look is is formulaic, and we can kind of, laugh at it since, Friends.
It sells. Everybody, and the thing is, I have a Pottery Barn couch.
Like, no, I know.
So do I.
The pieces themselves are fine. It's just in totality. The strange part.
Well, the strange part from a design, you walk into someone's home, you're a stranger, or maybe you were referred by someone, and you can't get a sense of what their individuality is because
because they're so generic.
Because it's generic, and that's what's beautiful about your book, is that
you take a swatch of fabric, and all of a sudden a garden blooms from that swatch of fabric.
Or a lantern, or small piece of furniture, So it's not there aren't recipes in here per se, but it's a way of thinking about it differently that I think speaks to this visual, this visual culture that we're in now.
Right.
So Alice and I can just bring the book to an appointment now.
Say,
Rochelle.
What do you want?
That's what I do.
Are you a sacred meadow or not?
Or are you a tropical noir?
Yeah. But the Thoreauvian one is my personal favorite. I when I took the quiz, I fell into the sacred meadow and I haven't gotten out, Rochelle.
I get a little stuck there too. I'm kind of a cross between a few, but I made the quiz, so I kind of know the answers that will take me one direction.
Yes, you definitely have.
Okay, I have not done the quiz, so I guess I need to.
You should, Alice. You should.
I'll do that later today. So another thing that I loved in the book was the 10 do in a day tasks to transform your garden. Yeah. I thought that was a brilliant list.
Very good.
Can you run through a few of those?
Oh, gosh. I'm actually trying to flip through that in the book because I don't even remember. But they're simple things like...
clean the edges.
Cleaning was a big part of it, yeah. Rochelle.
I loved cleaning the edges. Sweeping.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of a similar thing to than that you would do around your house. You know, you have company coming over.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do?
We always call that fake house. When you have people coming over, you have fake house, right? So you have to have fake garden, too. Like,
well, not really, but, you know, there
you
are
certain stuff in some annuals and pop in some color.
Yeah, you can do these sort of quick and simple, you know, little things that will make it, you know, sort of...
Seasonable and clean looking and, you know,
and fresh,
festive.
And just fresh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what we have to... We love talking about the book, and Alice and I obviously can talk about it for a long time, but we have to leave time for Pith and Vigor.
Yes.
Rochelle.
Okay.
The magazine that Alice and I love, that you've just published the first issue. Tell our listeners about it. Tell us how they can get a subscription and what it's all about.
Because they should get a subscription. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, well, I mean, the most amazing thing I think at this point about it is, I mean, it launched after a very successful Indiegogo campaign, which is a same sort of thing as Kickstarter.
Right.
And I have to say, for myself, that was a bit of a litmus test. I had this idea of kind of putting a new face on the idea of digital publishing, having come off of Leaf, which was a completely free model. Our idea there was to, you know, go digital, be 100% ad-based revenue. It didn't really work, though. There isn't quite, I mean, it's just not there yet. And so even though we had literally millions of readers, we you know, the whole idea of ad,
right,
ad-funded news publication just has gone away. Anyway, so, you know, this was kind of a different idea, but in the sense, so a few things. First of all, it's a newspaper, which we did that for a lot of reasons, but the most significant of which is the incredibly sort of light footprint of newspaper and the reusability and the ease of kind of moving it on to the whatever that next thing is, whether it's, you know, shredded up in your compost heap or folded into something interesting or whatever it is. We have this goal of featuring a project, something to do with it in
yeah,
every issue.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, I personally had a hard time making the jump from digital to a tangible thing, and one of those reasons was the environmental impact of that. And
yes.
Why am I doing this? However, I think there is something really beautiful about the tangible quality of a newspaper, and I think it pairs really well with gardening. It's something that's a little slower. It's a little more tactile, and we set out with this paper to kind of reinvent what a newspaper might look like, and make it something really beautiful rather than you know, what you might expect from, you know, the New York Times.
Yeah. The Gray
not
Lady.
They're not beautiful, but they're, you know, newspapers have a thing about them. And so we were really inspired by a lot of other publications that are sort of reinventing their niche and their chosen medium. You know, we were kind of looking at things like Kinfolk and Lucky Peach, which is in the food realm, and
right,
Modern Farmer,
right,
you know, as far as voice, as well as very substantially looking at edible publications, which went with a hyper-local sort of thing. And for us, we wanted to approach gardening from a local standpoint, which is largely undone unless it's you know, blogging or that kind of thing.
Yes.
Most of the big magazines, they try and cover the whole country for the most part.
Right.
And that's hard because our country is so vast and different.
Yeah.
And so we also want to help gardeners and provide lots of interesting information and tell stories, but we wanted to do that, you know, in a way that could support small businesses and people who are local artisans and all of that. And so, you know, by going with a hyper-local business model, we are more able to do that.
Yeah.
And
talk
more about local issues, people, plants, styles,
right.
vernaculars,
right.
landscapes, all of that. So,
so you really do think of it as regional. I mean,
I do.
Yeah,
We just have Tip and Vigor right now, but our vision is as we get into the next issue comes out in February. That's the second issue, and it will be quarterly. But you know, sometime into next year, definitely not with the next issue. But we want to start. We've already had interest from a whole variety of places. When can we have Tip and Vigor? You know, Oregon, for example,
right,
or
yeah.
even bigger,
right.
even had a request from France.
Wow.
So it's already happening. And it's just, at this point, I feel like, you know, we've been just kind of like putting that on the back burner because that is where we want to go. Is,
are you going to follow
regional publications, but, you know, we need to kind of get our feet on the ground and sort of one thing at a time ourselves
right.
at the moment. But that is the idea. Yeah.
Are you going to follow the Edible Magazine format of licensure, you know, because like
that's one of the things we're not sure about.
Okay.
We've been looking at that, and I just don't know what that answer is yet.
Yeah.
They do have, it's like a franchise.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure about that. Partly because what we'd really like to do is, which is very different than the edible publications, is our subscribers get a copy of the newspaper sent to them whenever it comes out. But as we have multiple versions, our plan is to send them their local version or whatever version they want,
right.
you know, whether it's New England or Oregon or wherever.
Right.
So they get that one in the mail. But, you know, their subscription gets them a password to the website where the content from all of the issues
is available. Yeah, that's great.
So it's for us, the thought is we're hoping that, you know, it's sort of a hybrid of a digital magazine and a print magazine in a way that I don't know of anybody else doing it. So, it is a different model. If we do a license thing, I don't know how all these things work. That's one of the things we're working on.
Right.
So.
Right.
In addition to designing gardens and
writing books
and
publishing newspapers
really quick, because we're running out of time. What's next for you? Are you going to do a rap song, or are you going to do a movie, or are you going to become a DJ?
What's next? I have to say that, first of all, we'll be doing Pith and Vigor for a while now. I don't know about future books or anything like that.
Pith and Vigor.
I just want to, Rochelle, we're putting ourselves out. I think Alice, what she's trying to say is that we would like to be featured in the video.
We've definitely been learning to do that. So we'll see.
I just want to dress up like Vita Sackville West.
That'd be fun.
Rochelle, thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had another hour to talk. But we will hopefully be reconnecting soon.
Yeah.
Winter's coming, and there's always a little bit of downtime.
And a trip up to Boston, could be a fun
in order.
Fun
will you please tell our listeners where they can get, how they can get Pith and Vigor,
and how they can buy the book,
and where they can get the book, and where you'll be next?
So Pith and Vigor is PithAndVigor, all spelled out, .com. And when you get there, there's buttons all over the place to subscribe. So, and you can also peruse some of the content from the first issue. The book is available wherever you can buy books. It's published by Timber Press, so you could go through them, but Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores all
Great.
Over the country. For me, I am having a little bit of quiet time before a springtime full of book signings and events. So we'll be at a bunch of the big garden shows across the country.
Great.
Seattle, down in Atlanta, a whole variety of things. Boston, New England. So a busy spring of getting out there and meeting people, talking about the book and the newspaper.
So. Well, thank you for all you've done to promote gardening and for sharing your story with us. We love the book and the magazine. And we will talk to you soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And I just want to shout out to every week we have a winner. Joan Chesley won last week. We haven't heard from you, Joan. Please get in touch with us so that we can send you your prize. And thank you to all of our new followers on Facebook.
We got quite an uptick this
week. Yes. And thank you for listening to We Dig Plants. See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.